Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this evening's lecture, which is co-sponsored by the Sun, Torii, and Toyota Centers for Research, the Center for Philosophy in the Social and Natural Sciences, and the Gender Institute. We are very fortunate this evening to have Professor Nancy Folbray with us, who is the Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts. Professor Folbray is a distinguished visitor to the Stickard Center and has been giving, I think, a large number of seminars, in my view, in the LSE, especially over the last week. And she is here as one of a number of visitors who are co-sponsored by the Gender Institute and by the Center for Philosophy in the Social and Natural Sciences. Now, Professor Folbray is a distinguished feminist economist. Her work has been in the area of political theory and economics. She's also done some work for the Population Council on lone mothers. And she has recently published a book, which many of you will be familiar with, the title of which is Who Pays for the Kids? And she has been involved in setting up a new journal for feminist economics. And for those of you who would like a flyer for that journal, I have some in my back pocket, metaphorically speaking. I would like you now to welcome Professor Folbray to give her lecture.
Thank you very much. I've really had a wonderful time as a visitor here at the LSE, and I've learned a great deal. And I really look forward to a lively discussion after this talk, for which I hope to leave ample time. Gender is now a popular, in fact, almost indispensable word in the development vocabulary. Most major international organizations, including the World Bank, now have special units that are devoted to research and policy formulation on women's issues. And these reports often have what seems to me a kind of cheerful, self-congratulatory tone, celebrating how much women have gained. Now, of course, there's still some poor, benighted countries where women remain downtrodden. But the West, with its wonderful credit policies, is helping them see the light and remedy the problem. And in these days of otherwise rather gloomy economics, it's sort of, I can see that it's nice to be in a good mood about something. But at the risk of raining on this happy parade, I have to say that I think that the picture is rather more complicated. In the course of economic development, women tend to gain new rights as individuals, but they also tend to become more economically vulnerable as mothers. Empirical studies that document improvements in educational levels and labor force participation and wages are all very nice and very important. And I think that the most compelling recent research on women and development digs a bit deeper and tries to understand the complex interaction between the family, property rights, and the growth of markets. In particular, I think there's an emerging feminist economics that focuses on the evolution of social institutions like property rights and the ways that they're shaped by gender-based collective action as well as by technical change. So what I'd like to do tonight is explore these issues here by way of looking at four different but related topics. The first is property rights in land. The second, what I would call property rights in family, the kind of explicit and implicit contracts that govern the intra-family distribution of income. Third, rights to protection against discrimination in the labor market. And fourth, rights to valorization, to the estimation and appreciation of the value of non-market work. Now, before I do that, let me explain a little bit more about what I mean when I say institutional economics. and explain how I think that kind of economics relates to the literature on women and gender and development. The women in development approach, which is sometimes affectionately called WID or WID literature, was kind of the first that emerged. It's about 20 years old, and it represents an application of modernization theory. It acknowledges that there are serious problems for women in the development process, but it treats them as kind of an oversight that you could remedy, that can be remedied by better efforts to incorporate them in the market economy. So from this perspective, gender bias exists, but it's kind of an anachronism. It reflects outdated norms and values that are no longer functional for society as a whole. So the favored prescription from this point of view is increased investments in women's human capital, provision of more education. And the emphasis is placed on large gains in overall efficiency that can result from a reduction in sex discrimination. So women's position in developed countries like the UK or the US is kind of held forth as a model for women in developing countries. Now, the gender and development literature that has emerged, sometimes called GAD, G-A-D, sounds as though it should be quite similar, but in fact the differences between it and the WID approach are pretty significant. Because the gendered approach tends to focus on the very persistent structural character of inequality between men and women. It looks at men's roles as well as women's roles in the development process. And it suggests that incorporating women is not enough, that the process of development itself might need to be changed. But the modification, the transformation, is likely to meet resistance from men because it will entail a redistribution of income along gender lines that may not be fully compensated by the gains in overall efficiency. From this point of view, women in the developed countries are not necessarily a great model for women in developing countries because they are in a disadvantaged position in the family, particularly with respect to the distribution of the cost of rearing children, the probability of experiencing poverty as a lone mother becomes increasingly high. Now, a lot has been written in the development literature lately about the difference between these two approaches, but their theoretical underpinnings remain largely unexplored. Advocates of women in development tend to use more quantitative methods and to do a lot of work with human capital models. I guess T. Paul Schultz is a good example of this approach. Advocates of gender and development often rely heavily on more descriptive data and on kind of more historical narrative with liberal sprinklings of the word empowerment, which is how it can often be identified. Now, both sides of this debate can be couched in the concepts of the new institutionalist economics, and I think that interpreted in this way, the gender and development literature provides some strong support for the institutionalist theory of rent-seeking coalitions. Now, rent-seeking is a term that economists have begun to use not to literally denote seeking rents in the sense that a landlord or a property owner does, but rather seeking sums of money that result from the exercise of ownership or power rather than the actual performance of any productive activity. I think the term originated with Ann Krieger in her work on special interest groups and their influence on tariff formation, where she would explain, say, the action of sugar farmers in trying to establish a protective tariff so that they could charge higher prices domestically for their sugar products as an example to her of rent-seeking behavior. But subsequently, a lot of institutionalist economics have begun to widen the term to apply it more broadly. And my argument here is that it can also be applied to gender. In general, the new institutionalist economics focuses on the evolution of social institutions that create the context in which individual decisions are made. So it's not really inconsistent with a neoclassical emphasis on utility maximization, but it suggests that that approach is inadequate and insufficient to understand what's really important about the development process. Now, social institution is a very broad term. It's hard to think of something that's not included in that category. Generally, it's used to describe organizations like the firm, the family, and the state, but also the political rules and the social norms that help organizations like these function. the stability, efficiency, and incentive structures of these social institutions have some pretty obvious implications for the process of economic development and also for the empowerment of social groups based on gender, as well as groups based on nation, race, class, or other dimensions of collective identity. Now, how do social institutions like property rights evolve? Why do they change over time? Well, there are kind of two different approaches to this question among institutionalist economists, and they kind of correspond roughly to the women in development and the gender in development approach. I think most institutionalist economists still want to talk about property rights as things that emerge, that evolve in response to the dictates of efficiency. In other words, you know, we're all engaged in kind of a process of competition. It's kind of analogous to a process of natural selection going on in the social world. And social institutions like private property or private land rights emerge because they provide an efficient way of solving a coordination problem and creating positive incentives. So the argument, for instance, is that private ownership of land emerges because it creates more incentives to property owners to invest in their land and increases productivity, and therefore systems based on private ownership will prevail for efficiency reasons in the long run. Well, Ronald Coase's very concise formulation of this approach to property rights provided a basis for later applications to the family. Much of Becker's work on the family kind of follows this reasoning. And Oliver Williamson's work on the firm kind of moves in the same direction. Now, I want to emphasize that from this point of view, just because a social institution or set of property rights is around today, it doesn't mean that it's perfectly optimal. It could be very much at risk of further competition by a new arrangement or a new system that's coming along. It may be still very much in a process of adjustment to changes in relative prices or incomes. There can be lags in the way social institutions change, kind of inertial tendencies. Cultural norms, in particular, tend to be very resistant to change. But despite these imperfections and lags, I think the underlying thrust of at least some institutionalist economics is that social institutions are evolving towards some efficient Pareto-optimal equilibrium. And this is exactly the theoretical perspective that underlies the optimistic view towards women in development. The alternative approach within institutionalist economics, I think, can be termed the distributional conflict paradigm. And it's a paradigm that insists on the importance of processes of collective aggrandizement. Jack Knight describes it as follows: the ongoing development of social institutions is not best explained as a Pareto superior response to collective goals or benefits, but rather as a byproduct of conflicts over distributional gains. So this is not to say that social institutions don't have some important efficiency implications that deserve attention, but to observe that they also are almost always more efficient for some groups than for others. They strengthen the position, the advantage, the bargaining power of one group with respect to another. And so you can expect, in the process of social evolution, some obstacles, some resistance, that are not just a manifestation of lags or inertia, but of active resistance. And there may be very powerful groups who are, in fact, willing to pay a pretty high price in terms of reduced efficiency for continued control over a disproportionate share of the output. In other words, groups may prefer a larger slice of an existing pie than a smaller slice of a even larger pie. It depends on the relative size of the pies. Now, men and women are not literally interest groups in this sense, that we don't normally choose our own gender in the same sense that we join a club, although this is now within the realm of possibility. But men and women often do identify with others of the same gender, define common interests, and engage in various forms of collective action, ranging from participation in explicit formal activity, let's say going to a conference in Beijing, to less formal efforts to defend or to develop advantageous social norms, which could take the form of a spirited argument at a pub. Now, a large body of feminist theory, as well as much of the gender and development literature that I want to talk about, illustrates the way that male collective action has led to the development of social institutions, particularly property rights, that provide men with important economic advantages in control, not just over property, but also in control over income and labor. And what this also shows is that women have increasingly begun to engage in collective action to contest and modify such institutions. Now, among policymakers in the development field, there's kind of a tendency to avoid consideration of conflict, I think partly out of a fear of intensifying it. And the women in development process, the women in development approach, because it's so cheerful and upbeat, it's got this everybody gains emphasis on increasing efficiency, is especially appealing to policymakers in multilateral institutions. But it seems to me that policymakers could benefit from a more forthright analysis of the distributional gains and the losses that policies impose on social groups. You might as well bite the bullet, admit that there's some conflict of interest along gender as well as other lines, and set about trying to mediate it in a reasonably efficient and equitable manner. At the same time, I think that if the gender and development literature, people doing this kind of work in the field, if they could think a little bit more about the logic of institutional economics, it could help them move forward in some very positive ways. Because although the political implications are somewhat unpleasant, I think it's important to concede that hierarchy and inequality sometimes serve very important economic functions by lowering transactions costs and solving coordination problems. And more egalitarian alternatives are unlikely to be successful unless they are at least as efficient. For example, challenges to traditional male authority must be accompanied by alternative ways of enforcing familial obligations and encouraging commitments to children. I think the historical experience of developed countries suggests that the weakening of patriarchal relations within the family is accompanied by a discernible weakening of intra-family income flows and a growth in poverty among mothers and children on their own. Excuse me. Finally, I think trying to be more analytical and a little bit more model-oriented could help the gender and development literature address what I think is the most serious theoretical weakness in this approach, which is the difficulty of specifying the relationship between different kinds of social groups and the resulting overlaps between different kinds of rent-seeking activity. I think there's a very, very clear analogy between forms of collective aggrandizement that are based on gender and those that are based on other dimensions of collective identity. Men often gang up on women. But likewise, men and women in strong groups often gang up on men and women in weak groups. And one implication of this is that women's best interests are not always going to be served by simple gender allegiance or gender solidarity. As many scholars and activists from developing countries have emphasized, women are members of distributional coalitions that are defined by nation and race and class and other factors as well as gender, and the kinds of inequality that they resist and the types of collective action that they are going to participate in are very much a function of specific political and historical circumstances. So I guess what I'd like to encourage is more research on the form and the timing and intensity of gender conflict in different countries, partly because it could help us sort out the logic of other kinds of collective conflict and the influence that it exercises on the bigger picture. Okay, well, let me take a look at property rights from this perspective. Property rights in land are very much tied to family law because individuals gain a claim to property normally either through inheritance or marriage. And so analyzing family law and property rights is complicated. In most regions there are kind of parallel systems. There's a legal, there are a set of legal arrangements, there are a set of religious and cultural values that also play a very important role. And also, our knowledge and understanding of property rights is fairly uneven. Most of the research so far has focused on sub-Saharan Africa and on South Asia, although there's also a little evidence from Latin America. But I think it's safe to generalize as follows, that women have the less access to land than men, and largely as a result, they have less access to credit and to technical extension services. So they're less able to use agriculture as a viable means of providing for their own subsistence. Now, patriarchal rules of land transmission and ownership are not determined by the market. It's not a market process. It's a social institution. In some ways, it's inconsistent with the market. It doesn't encourage equal competition among men and women farmers. And while these property rights have some functional implications, which I want to address right now, I think it's also very clear that they provide men with the opportunity, if not always the perfect opportunity, at least some opportunity, to extract monopolistic rents from women, not in the sense of charging women more money in the way a landlord would, but in the broader sense of reducing the income that they have control over per hour that they work. Because what traditional patriarchal property rights do is they define the male head of household as what economists call the residual claimant of the household enterprise, with property rights over what is left over after all of the expenses of the household have been met. And that provides that individual owner with pretty specific and powerful incentives to maximize their share of output and leisure. And we think that these incentives are countervailed to some extent by familial affection and altruism, but we don't really know to what extent. Well, why are there such similarities, cross-regional similarities, in these kinds of property rights, patriarchal property rights connected to patriarchal forms of family law? Well, they seem to reflect the fact that in most areas of the world, women have only very recently begun to participate in the formal specification of property rights. So we observe a priori that it's not likely to be a system that works very much in their interest, since they had very little voice in its formation and development. But I think that there is a kind of functional institutional logic behind the system that economists and demographers have begun to kind of uncover, and that is this. In traditional patriarchal systems, land ownership gave fathers considerable leverage over children, and so allowed them to expect at least some benefits in the form of labor contributions and support in old age. Now, this system intensified the economic incentives for coercive forms of control over women, but it also provided some implicit rate of return for women's reproductive labor within the family economy. So as a result, men who abused or neglected the mothers of their children or the children themselves lowered their own economic welfare. In the aggregate, one could argue that male control over property provided an enforcement mechanism that provided incentives for paternal care of dependents with pronatalist effects, but also with kind of pro-family effects. Now, one conspicuous negative side effect of an incentive structure like that is the relative neglect of female children. And an example of the kind of economic instrumental reasoning that I'm applying here is the literature that shows that in economies where, in fact, daughters are much more expensive to raise than our sons, daughters tend to receive a lower investment of parental resources in terms of health, education, and medical care. And really all I'm doing is generalizing this argument to children in general and suggesting that when you see a very rapid and disruptive increase in the cost of children, you may see some decline in parental willingness to devote adequate time and resources to the care of children, particularly if the costs of defecting from the family or defaulting on the implicit contract of parental responsibility are very low. And I think the rise of wage employment and the shift from a family economy to an economy based on individual wage labor is very much at the heart of this transformation. Because with this shift towards an increasingly individual economy, the obligations to care for kin become increasingly dependent on altruism alone. And don't misunderstand me. I think altruism is a very strong and powerful force. But I think that unaccompanied by any economic incentives or economic reinforcement, it becomes a slightly unreliable and very risky strategy for the provision of dependence. Maximization of fertility becomes a less attractive economic strategy, and that's one of the reasons that fertility declines, which is the part of the adjustment process that seems to make a lot of sense. But at the same time, that increasing cost of raising children has some very negative distributional consequences for women and children who become much more dependent on their own resources and much more vulnerable to desertion than they've been in previous periods. And I think that that's one reason why you see an increased emphasis among women in developing countries on trying to mobilize for increased land rights and increased property rights to land. Now, I don't know, you know, at this stage I could point to some important successes in countries like India where property rights have been, at least in law, modified to some extent, and which I think that there are further possibilities for more egalitarian distribution. But I think it really remains to be seen how successful women will be in their various collective efforts to demand an equal control over property within marriage and equal property rights. Okay, family law. I think you can consider the claims of mothers and children on the income of fathers as a property right that's analogous to ownership of land or of the output of a family farm, although they're also human rights. They're not just property rights. I would argue that they're also human rights, and they're certainly shaped as much by social norms as by actual laws and legislation. But historically, these contracts, these implicit contracts of family life, have been primarily defined by men and have provided men with some very important economic benefits. Now, the traditional view, the traditional neoclassical economic view, is that, hey, marriage is just efficient. Marriage emerged because there's a division of labor. When men specialize in the market and women specialize in childbearing, they're both better off because of gains to trade. But if this were the case, you would expect there to be some fairly strong guarantees in family law that would protect and enforce the claims of the person who specializes in non-market work upon the income of the person who gains market earnings. And you don't find such guarantees in any major tradition of family law. Fathers have always been expected and exhorted to provide for their wives and their children. But when they have failed to do so, they have very seldom been subject to any very serious or sustained negative economic sanctions, particularly if they could escape or migrate from their community of origin and thereby avoid the kind of cultural stigma that might be associated with it. Now, even as recently as 10 years ago, the claim that there might be some conflict and inequality within the family, that altruism might not be absolutely perfect there, was considered a very far-fetched claim. And I know this because I was one of the people making it who was considered very far out. But since then, there have been a number of empirical studies that I think have shifted the burden of proof to those who would assume that the family can be treated as an undifferentiated unit. And the traditional neoclassical model in which the family is just a unit has been supplemented, if not completely supplanted, by a new generation of bargaining power models. Now, most interesting to me from an institutionalist perspective are models that show how property rights affect microeconomic outcomes. And the way they do that is that they influence the fallback position for someone who's involved in negotiation within a marriage or a family situation, where their fallback situation is simply what they will do if negotiation breaks down, where they will go, what they can resort to. And I think the best example I could give here, again, is poor enforcement of child support responsibilities. This does not merely affect women who are divorced or who have out-of-wedlock children. It affects every woman who is a mother, because what poor enforcement of paternal child support responsibilities does is it reduces the fallback position, it weakens the fallback position of a mother should she threaten to leave the household. Therefore, it diminishes her ability to affect the allocation of goods and leisure time or even qualitative decisions within the household. Now, again, don't get me wrong here. I don't want to overstate my position. I don't think people in families bargain all the time, every day, maybe not even once a year, over who's going to get what. It's just too unpleasant and it's too much trouble. It's not very efficient as a solution to a coordination problem. But I think what families do is that they rely on cultural norms about who should get what, who should do the dishes, who should take out the garbage, who should meet financial responsibilities. And what happens is that some people get dissatisfied with those cultural norms. And if they have a fair amount of economic bargaining power, or if they just feel particularly strongly or intensely about it, they behave in ways that violate those norms. And as more and more of them do it, those norms begin to change. And so I think what I'm saying is my prediction here is that when you see improvements in support of paternal child support responsibilities, you're likely to see not just an improvement in the welfare of lone mothers, but a discernible change in the willingness of women in married relationships to speak up and to speak out and demand a more egalitarian division of labor within the home. So taking this to the micro level is important, because taking it to the micro level helps you understand what the incentives are, what the incentives people have to participate in collective action. You know, the reason that you might, or that one might want to get involved in an argument or a debate or a demonstration or an organization around gender rights or the definition of appropriate gender roles is that it has these really discernible implications for the organization of one's own daily life. Well, I don't mean to suggest here that economic development always leads to family breakdown or to reductions in paternal commitments, or that always and everywhere there will be an increase in the percentage of families that are maintained by women alone. But I do think that this transition to wage employment and the growth of economic individualism increases the risk of what we could call family failure, and that we ought to think of in terms kind of analogous to market failure or state failure. I mean, the fact is that all of the social institutions that we rely on to solve coordination problems have failures. They don't work under certain circumstances, and that's why we begin in an adaptive way to think about renegotiating them and modifying them. And you can see this process going on right now with respect to social policy and family policy in developing countries as well as in the developed countries. And what a theory of distributional coalitions based on gender leads us to predict is that women's groups who are seeking reforms on things like improved paternal child support enforcement will meet considerable resistance from men, not all men, not men everywhere, not men all the time, but that there will be generally a tendency for people to mobilize to some extent along gender lines. And in fact, that's what we see if we go and look at the political melodrama that's been emerging over this issue in a lot of different places. I think another insight that comes from this approach is that it might help us understand why in some countries women actually are not very enthusiastic about cultural modernization. And in fact, they might find religious fundamentalism a somewhat reassuring and, in fact, economically advantageous form of collective action to participate in. And that may be because in certain circumstances, male-dominated modernization offers them much less than male-dominated tradition. And again, this relates, I mean, it has very much to do with how much their individual opportunities are likely to improve relative to how much their family position is likely to deteriorate. And one of the things we need to do is try and figure out a way to systematically examine how these contradictory aspects of the development process are affecting the way in which women think about it and which the way in which they talk and argue about what development means and is going to mean for them. Okay, property rights in the labor market. I'll be briefer here in this section talking about the way the labor market works. The property rights I've talked about so far in land and on with respect to claims of family income have very clear implications for the labor market. What they suggest is that women are in a weaker bargaining position. They will have a lower reservation wage. They will be willing to work for a lower wage than men are because their fallback position to wage employment, which is their share of some family output, is lower than men's share tends to be. And yet, you know, this emphasis on property rights is almost entirely missing from the literature on wage inequality in developing countries, which focuses almost entirely on human capital models and on differences in individual levels of education. And differences in individual levels of education are very important. They are a major determinant of individual earnings. But it's also true that improvements in women's education alone do not necessarily bring about an improvement in their relative earnings. And the best historical example of that, verification of that, is the experience of the United States, where women steadily improved their schooling levels between about 1920 and about 1970, but experienced no improvement at all in their relative earnings. It really wasn't until the 1970s when they were able to combine higher access to education with a collective mobilization that implemented specific policies, anti-discrimination laws, and also created a kind of cultural shift, a kind of delegitimation of the notion of unequal pay that had, I think, a very powerful but very diffuse effect. You know, it wasn't until this happened that the improvements in women's levels of education were really able to have much impact. Now, there's a lot of evidence from developing countries that some employers just overtly discriminate against women. There's evidence from others that they like to hire women because they can pay women lower wages and enjoy higher profitability as a result. And this may be a kind of example of kind of a global cultural learning process where multinational corporations are more likely to violate local cultural norms and go for the cheaper source of labor than would be a more locally owned, locally managed type of capitalist firm. But what interests me most about the labor market picture in developing countries is the role that government plays and doesn't play in promoting gender equality. Because laws against discrimination are not routinely enforced. There's no evidence that they have carry very much weight. And most structures of public benefits, social security systems, this is particularly true in Latin America, are for much more generous, well, they kind of reinforce a traditional male breadwinner, female dependent role that has some very distinct disadvantages for women. They also tend to impose upon individual employers the cost of raising the next generation, because employers who hire women often are forced by law to provide daycare centers or to provide maternity leave in such a way that increases the cost of hiring women rather than male workers, or gives them incentives to fire women when they reach a certain age, or when they marry, or when they begin to have children. And all of these aspects of gender bias in employment benefits violate International Labor Office guidelines, as well as the United Nations sort of rules of the game. But there still is remarkably little research on how such policies could improve and what impact differences across countries in such rules might have on labor market outcomes. Sometimes it's suggested, and this is a very common argument among economists, that women just have a greater preference for children than men do, and that they they embrace the extra cost of raising children because they get so much pleasure from the intrinsic meaning of parenthood. And, you know, you could argue that this is the case to some extent, although I don't think it explains very much of the difference in men's and women's earnings. I think it may have a discernible impact. But this argument is not a very satisfying one unless you kind of assume that maternal preferences like this are just exogenously given and not likely to change. And if you take an institutionalist approach, I think you come to a different conclusion, that preferences like these are partially shaped by social norms, and social norms are influenced by distributional coalitions. So it's not surprising that as you see women gaining some economic independence, what they begin to do is challenge social norms of femininity and social norms of maternity that are costly to them. And I think in the developed countries already, you see them quite effectively challenging a kind of the traditional social construction of masculinity and femininity in ways that that could ultimately prove costly for men, and also in ways that kind of raise some dilemmas for society as a whole. Because if we see a reduction in feminine levels of maternal altruism and in commitment to family without a concomitant increase in men's altruism and commitments to family altruism, we're going to see an overall decline in familial altruism, and that is going to leave us in a very difficult position in terms of trying to guarantee the health and well-being of children and the elderly and dependents in general. Now, I think a lot of feminists are prepared to argue and have argued that public provision of childcare and of support for parenthood in ways that would diminish the cost to women in particular of raising kids would also have important efficiency gains, also make us all better off in terms of overall productivity. In other words, you know, you can make the case on efficiency grounds. But the problem, the reason why it's so difficult to do this is that economists continue to ignore the importance of non-market work and to refuse to really gather data on the amount of time that's devoted to non-market work or the amount of time that's devoted to child rearing. And there's a whole realm of the economy that's sort of outside of the market nexus, outside of the exchange nexus, where there are important changes in productivity going on. Some of them may be very positive. Some of them may be very negative, but we don't really know what they are because we haven't developed a systematic way of summarizing them. And really the only way to take these arguments further and to make them more specific and to make them more empirical is to develop a statistical infrastructure that does allow us to monitor and estimate and consider the implications of a reallocation of time where people spend, you know, less on family labor and more on efforts to get an individual wage. I think there's a lesson here for policy debates over privatization and reduction in social safety nets. Childrearing is no longer a remunerative activity, and both individuals, well, not just individuals and not just companies, but also countries that devote a lot of time and energy or a large share of their budget to it, may have a hard time competing with parallel institutions that don't. And yet, we do have good reason to believe that time devoted to that activity has a very positive effect on productivity and overall efficiency. And if we don't somehow mobilize and develop better ways of investing in children in the next generation, we're likely to see our collective welfare decline. There are many advocates for women in development that talk about equality and the need for greater equality between men and women. But I think what we've learned, and this is kind of a summary of what I've tried to put across, is it's a lot easier to get equal rights for women than it is to impose equal responsibilities for the care of children and other dependents on men. Because this is a move that offers fewer efficiency gains for men than does the process of equal rights for women elsewhere. Now, some conservatives will argue that women have become too powerful and that their independence and their self-assertion threaten the very viability of the family. But it may be, and I guess I think it is, that women have simply not become collectively powerful enough to persuade men and society as a whole to fairly share the costs of raising the next generation. And whether we ever will do that, something that remains to be seen. Thank you.
Professor Fulbright will take a few questions. As she said, she's keen for a discussion. So, is there anybody who would like to ask a question? Yes, please.
Just to ask you.
Yes. Okay. Since you're first.
Well, actually, I think that the success of both groups has been very uneven.
Yeah.
I mean, there are now systematic data gathering efforts in Europe, in at least 7 European countries, to develop satellite accounts for monitoring women's non-market work. And there are also similar efforts underway to try and modify the way in which we treat environmental capital. And I think those two efforts are very complementary ones. And I'm really puzzled. I don't really understand why there hasn't been more consistency in the ways that countries have adopted one but not the other. But I think it's partly just a function of kind of specific historical and cultural circumstances. And I, of course, would be tempted to argue that there's a distributional coalition that's at work there, that it's hard to see who would be hurt or who would look bad with a set of green accounts, although there's certain industries that will look worse than others, right? Whereas it's not hard to predict sort of how a set of non-market labor accounts might make people uncomfortable. Yeah. I think that's been a long-standing feature of the peculiar interaction between racial and gender inequality in the U.S. And a lot of it has a kind of institutional logic, which is that kind of the confluence of political pressures has made it very advantageous to hire highly educated black women.
Yeah.
Well, the costs of children go up. So the family is, so if you're, put yourself in the position of sort of thinking in economic terms as a head of household in an agricultural economy where your family size decisions are basically determined by social norms that you've kind of inherited from the previous generation. And what you do, you expect
you hope to have a large family, and you expect that your children will begin to work at a very early age, and that if they, when they do go to work, perhaps they'll stay in school a bit longer than you thought. But when they do go to work, they'll earn higher wages, and they'll send more wages home to you. And so you will benefit, you expect to enjoy some remuneration for the time that you put into raising them. But instead, what you find is that the cost of children are going up, school requirements are going up, school fees are going up. You see in your town or your village that a lot of the young men and women who are highly educated, who have left home and gone off to the city and gotten jobs, don't remit very much money home to their parents. And you, what you do, you perceive a general, you get less than you anticipated getting from this investment in the family economy. And, you know, what if then some external event comes along, like a drought or a famine? You know, you may find that your best bet for individual survival is to migrate elsewhere and to leave the family behind and go off in search of some wage employment, okay? And once you go off and migrate there, you know, to the city, trying to find some way to support yourself, you may be less likely to send money back home than you would otherwise have been, because you anticipate spending less time at home. And this whole sort of process of migration and mobility kind of exaggerates and amplifies the process of reduced rate of return on investments in the family, as it were.
Okay.
What is it that you think accounts for that, Sylvia?
Certainly agree.
There's a question here.
Well, I understand.
It is difficult. But I think I'm not trying to impose the same chronology or the same priorities on other countries as have emerged in the developed countries. I'm trying to emphasize, I think it is of necessity different. And it's of necessity different partly because of the impact of colonialism and of the enormous impact of national differences within the world economic order. But I do think it is really important to have a research agenda that allows us to ask exactly how things are different. You know, will Kenyan families remain more loyal? Will remittances to families, are they higher? Will they continue to be high? Will they be higher in some regions than in others? You know, are there some institutional arrangements that provide better support for children under those conditions, you know, under in this process of economic development or not? And my interest is in trying to think about a research agenda along those lines.
Yeah.
That's right. I think in some respects, well, I think there are a variety of reasons. I think there's a kind of political movements have a kind of rhythm, and there, I think at least in the United States, we have gone through a period of very very rapid change and very rapid modification of gender roles. And now there's a backlash. There's an anxiety, there's a concern, there's a lot of resistance. In fact, there's much more. When the women's movement began, or really not began, but kind of got re-energized in the 1970s, I think it caught men unaware. It was kind of a surprise attack. And for that reason, it was quite successful. And what's happened now is it's elicited an enormous response, enormous resistance, not only from men, who are now organized in a more concerted way about it, but also from conservatives who I think are quite concerned about, and in some ways I guess I'm arguing quite rightly concerned about, the possibility that we've criticized traditional gender roles without really providing an alternative that will really guarantee the safety and well-being of dependents. So I think there's a sense of pause in the United States right now about this, whereas in a lot of developing countries, that's less the case. There are more conspicuous legal and social inequalities that persist. That's easier to perhaps a little bit to mobilize around at this time. So, you know, who knows what, you know, who knows what will happen next? It's just something that we need to keep an eye on.
I find myself shuddering.
them. In fact, I might be worsening the problem by identifying the problem as in such economic terms. I might be worsening the very problem that I'm pointing to. I've worried about that. But I do think but I've also reflected on it quite seriously. And I do think, as an economist, it is my job, to think about the kind of economic incentives and pressures that might undermine trust and reciprocity and caring behavior. And I think the reason why norms of trust and reciprocity and caring are diminishing is not that people like me aren't exhorting people to behave that way more. I think it's because people just get the sense more and more that they're just punished and penalized for practicing those kinds of behaviors. And that makes sense, because they're the kind of behaviors that the only way you can reward and reinforce them is if you make some collective commitment to reward and reinforce them. They generally will never be rewarded by a totally individualistic and competitive system. I guess I think it's also important to think about the demise of the socialist vision, and to remember that there were many who argued there that all that was necessary was to have the right ideals and to have the right to develop a kind of cultural transformation of human nature that could make that possible. But in the end, the failure to develop a viable economic system that was consistent with that moral vision proved pretty fatal. So I think that's another reason to be very serious about the economics of family policy. Well, certainly, I think want to have a situation where a man who, or man or woman, husband, mother or father, who leaves a family, should not experience an improvement in their individual standard of living. We would like it to be kind of economically neutral. Whereas what we've had in effect is a situation where there have been, it's not just that there have been no sanctions, it's that there's been a positive economic incentive. You know, we basically created a situation where, I don't know the figures for the UK, but in the US, the figures are something like, in the event of divorce, an individual man's standard of living increases by about 20%, while that of a wife and children tends to decline by even more than that amount. And I guess one factor is that child support there tends to be set in absolute terms rather than in relative terms, rather than as a fixed percentage of the absent parent's income. And what that has meant is that there's been even more of an incentive for wealthy and affluent men, because their child support payments are a smaller percentage of their income.
Yes.
I think domestic violence is a factor that affects women's bargaining power within marriage. And the more poorly you enforce protections for women, or against just the physically weaker, more vulnerable partner in a marriage, you know, I think that has very clear implications in terms of the overall allocation of bargaining power within the home. I've never seen discussion of this issue in the neoclassical literature. There is some discussion of it in the bargaining power literature. And what it shows is a somewhat contradictory result, which is that there tends to be more domestic violence whenever there's, or the likelihood of domestic violence is increased whenever there's a big change, when a woman suddenly earns more income or suddenly earns less. It's not the case that just earning more income protects you against domestic violence. What it does is it sets off such a destabilization of the existing arrangement that it increases the risk, which I think is kind of an interesting finding.
Well, I think we should continue this discussion on the fifth floor, where we'd be happy to offer you all a drink. Not least because the LSE has deemed it necessary to put the air conditioning on the very day after they first put the heating on this winter, which is why people are fleeing from the room. I would like to thank Professor Folbray very much indeed for a splendid lecture on some of the economic imperatives forcing family change in a wide variety of contexts. And I would like to thank her also for coming to the LSE and spending a month with us. We have very much enjoyed her company, and we hope that she'll come again. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.